Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Wednesday, so I'm going to come up with another yard site. Happens to be that tomorrow is Zion Adar. That's Moshe Rabbeinu, obviously. I'm not going to give a podcast on Moshe Rabbeinu. But it's also the Kli Yakar, as it happens to be. It's one of my interesting figures, interesting characters. Ephraim Lunschitzer, Shlomo Ephraim Lunschitzer. I know the name doesn't necessarily mean anything to you, but everybody's heard of the Kli Yakar, and that's his most famous book, and that's quoted in Dvar Torahs all the time. Everybody in a shul or anywhere they got a Dvar Torah, they're going to do a Kli Yakar. And here you have a famous rabbi. They're not the same. Each one of these people is a different and unique personality. That's what makes it interesting. Otherwise, it'd be boring, you know. Then the person was a genius, a big rabbi, had a long beard, and he died. You know, that would be boring. Each one is interesting. The Kli Yakar, or Rabbi Ephraim Lunschitzer, as they call him, was in Poland, in the golden age of the Jews in Poland. He lived like from 1540, I think, to 1620. He was about 80 years old when he died, something like that. And that was the time to live in Poland. I mentioned last week that once upon a time, the Jews, the Ashkenazic Jews, I'm speaking about the Ashkenazim, used to be in a place called Ashkenaz, which was first France and then Germany. But then they eventually kicked out of there by the anti-Semitism in the Middle Ages. And they ended up in this gigantic country called Poland, the Kingdom of Poland, which no longer exists. And there the Jews settled down and they did well for a variety of reasons that I won't reprise. And not only did they do well politically and economically, but because they're Ashkenazic Jews, they're very culturally insular, or as we would say today, very frumy yeshivish. And so the result was that they used the money to build up a whole network of yeshivas and learning and things like that. And that's what they mean when they say the golden age of the Jews in Poland. He lived in the right time, in the 1500s and in the first half of the 1600s. If you were Jewish and you lived in Poland and you knew how to make a living, there's always poor people, but there are plenty of people that weren't, then you did pretty well, and it was a good economy, and the Jews were pretty much left alone as long as they paid high taxes, which they did. And then the Jews really ran their own show. It's like living a state within a state almost. Just imagine 500 curious Yoels, you know, to use American terms. Something along, not exactly, because they didn't have all Jewish towns, but something along those lines. And the big rabbis at that time were big rabbis, because people with money sent their kids to yeshiva, or they had hired private tutors. In other words, if you were rich, take, for example, the father of Rama, who also lived in the early 1500s. He was loaded. He was a very successful businessman. He didn't send his son to college. That's not what you did in the 1500s. He hired for him super teachers to teach the kid at a young age, you know, Gemara and Pilpul and Lumdus and all this sort of thing, because Rama was a genius, so it worked. And so the father could say, see, I got all the prestige out of it because my son became a Gadol Hador, and his name will resound forever throughout history. Didn't need to send him to become an accountant and make a little bit extra money, or a doctor or something like that. I wanted him to be a famous Jew. That's the environment, the atmosphere he had long ago in the golden age of Jews in Poland. Then things went bad, but I'm talking about when the times were good. And Ephraim Lunschitzer, his yard site is tomorrow, the Kli Yakar, he lived in that time. See, you have to have mazel and luck to live at the right time in the right place, as we in America perhaps know. And so he was, you know, your typical situation, a smart boy. He went to yeshiva, I think by the Marshal, not that that means anything to you. And he was very good in learning, and later on he became a Rav and a Rosh Yeshiva. But that's not where his unique talent was. This is what makes things interesting. I told you, these are real people, not cookie-cutter individuals. People going to yeshiva aren't necessarily all the same. They might be all smart in learning. I'm serious, they're going to be very good in learning. But that's not what particularly turns a guy on. Somebody might be drawn, for example, to halacha. There are certain types like that. And other people are not drawn to halacha. They're into lomdus. It's just a different type. And the third type of person was into what we would say today, agadata. Machshava, Musar, the non-legal parts of the rabbinic literature. And that was him, Ephraim Lunschitzer, Shlomo Ephraim Lunschitzer. he was a big guttle, and he knew how to learn all that. It goes without saying. He was a rabbi in Prague, for example. That's no small business. He was a Rosh Hashiva in place, which means he had to give shiurim. So as far as the Gemara and the Halacha, that he knew. But his unique talents lay in being a fantastic speaker. This is going to sound silly, but you know what I mean. He was like Rabbi Friend at that time. The koch was being a very good speaker, a sought-after speaker. And not everybody can speak. I got news for you. In the old types of rabbis from long ago, speaking was not on the chart. The overwhelming majority of our great gedolim in the past couldn't speak to save their lives, because that's not what the community hired them for. They hired them to be a genius in Gemara and Lumdus and all that sort of thing, to speak over everybody's head. Otherwise, if you're not, what kind of a gadol are you? And to run a little yeshiva, perhaps, sometimes large yeshiva, in which you do all the lumdus with the guys. In addition to that, a rav had to be a posek. I'm talking about people, rabbis of communities. They didn't have rabbis of shul like we have nowadays. And they certainly weren't clergy people. And therefore, the job of the rabbi is to sit and learn, to teach smart people, and to preside over Beis Din, and answer hard shilas. And that's basically it. So for that, all you have to do is just have a big brain. You don't speak at a bar mitzvah. You don't speak at a funeral. You don't give speeches on Shabbos, obviously. You don't go around and visit the sick. And, you know, you certainly don't spend all your time, you know, attending silly functions that would just to kiss up to some rich people. None of that. They're expected to sit and learn. Matter of fact, there's a very famous story. How's it go? In Vilna, the time in Vilna Gaon reminds me, there was a rabbi there who was hired by the community to be the communal rabbi, and they fired him because he said, "We walked by your house at 2 in the morning, and the lights were out. We're paying you to sit and learn 24/7. What's wrong with you?" You know, so that's what the job of the rabbi was. Now, it doesn't automatically mean, if somebody's big in learning, that they can't speak to save their life. That's usually the way it is. But you had exceptions, and the Kliarka was an exception. He happened to be very good in learning, but he also was an unbelievably good speaker, in Yiddish, of course. Unbelievably good speaker. And when I say good speaker, with all the tricks of the Magid of old, here we come into a very interesting office that doesn't really exist anymore. In the old days, long ago, they would divide up the religious leadership into two roles, A and B. A was the Rav, like I just described before, the learner, the posek, that sort of thing, the Beis Din guy. And B was somebody called the Magid. Now would you think some traveling itinerant, whatever. There was to be an official position in the city. The person who's a Rav, his job is to become an expert in the Halacha and the Gemara and the Mefarshim, and that's a whole lifetime, you know, business. He doesn't need to know the Agadah Tepars, what you call the Ein Yaakov. He doesn't need to know the Midrashim and the stories, because that's not what his skill set requires. He has to know the Shaos and Tshuvas. He has to know the legal precedents. He has to be able to think in a legalistic way, in a creative way. You know, that's what the job required. But people, most people, aren't into learning. They admire somebody who's a big learner. But think for, just off the top of my head, think of the women who weren't into learning at all at that time because, you know, it was a separate society. And think of most of the men, to be perfectly honest. And if you want to get really down and dirty, even most of the guys who learn the yeshiva can't learn that well. So they're not going to go and, you know, listen to some fancy schmancy shiur from some genius on some recondite topic and know what he's talking about. They might pretend they do, they might nod their head. It's not really for them. The public wants a speaker who can speak to them at their level and can explain the Torah in plain words in a way that brings a Musar Haskel or makes you feel good or perhaps makes you feel bad. Notice it talks to your heart, okay? That's what they want. And that's the Magid. He was hired by a city usually or something like that, a sizable community. He's supposed to be the speaker on occasions. He will speak on Shabbos, not, God forbid, before Musaf. But in the afternoon, some places on Friday night, some places during the week. And he's a very good speaker people come to hear. Otherwise, he wouldn't get the job. What makes a Magid? There, you don't have to know all the Halach and the Pilpul and all that. You have to know the Agadata, what we call today an Ein Yaakov. Ein Yaakov is a collection of all the Agadatas in the Gemara. He has to know the Medrash. Perhaps I would use the term Chumash and Rashi for the more simple Magids, because Rashi is a collection mostly of Midrashim and things like that. And Agadatas. And you have to be able to take those stories that you find in the Gemara, or you find in the Tanakh, or you find in the Medrash Rab or places like that, and then you weave them together in such a way to make them relevant to your audience, obviously. So you have to be an expert in Agadata literature. If you want to be a cut above that, then in addition to what I just described, somebody's Magidim would know the Jewish philosophical literature, because we had the Rambam, Mor Nevuchim, and the Kuzari, and the Chovos HaLevavos and Sadia Gaon. These are all books of philosophy and hashkof and ideas. And if you know that, you have a lot of material out of which to build speeches. Take it from me. And they would wow them. The Kli Yakar, whose yard sale is tomorrow, was the big expert in the 16th century among the Polish Jews, which was the largest Jewish community in the world. He was the big expert in what I just described in the Magidus. It so happened he also wore another hat. He could Paskin Shilas, he was a big Rav, he was Rosh Hashiva, he did that too. But where he excelled, and what he became famous for, was the Agadata stuff, as I just said before, which is why he's beloved by the masses at that time, because they can understand what the guy's saying. Understand? Now, what's really interesting about him is, first of all, he published a lot of his stuff in books, and I'll get to that a little later, but those are very good cheater books for any rabbi who's worth 10 cents. I mean, people should know that sort of thing. But he also made the Kli Yakar, which is just, Vorts on the Parsha, shall we say, commentaries on the Parsha, and that's a hot bestseller. And the I won't say the unique, but one of the unique things about him is a big social critic. People liked him because he called it like he saw it, and he wasn't afraid to tell the rich people to jump in a lake if they're doing something wrong, and he wasn't afraid to call out the hypocrites in front of their face, and that's why he had a lot of shtellers, because after a while, the powers that be didn't like somebody speaks a little too plainly and lets him have it and calls it like he sees it, and they would move on to another town. That's kind of the idea. I just opened at random my Kli Yakar that I have next to me in my office, and I see now we're in Vayikra, and the next week is the week or so, Shemini Tazrim, I'm looking at Mitzora in a couple of weeks, and he's a long business in Parchim Mitzora, Taras, about the Lashon Hara. You know, Taras is for Lashon Hara, they say. And I just quote you a tiny passage. He says, he has a long passage, and he says, why am I going so long? Because you guys stink. I got a little bit off track to speak of Lashon Hara, even if it's not directly about the Parsha. Because I see that this generation is lousy with Lashon Hara. But Saras Neshenesi, this generation, he's talking to his audience, which, by the way, were VIPs and rich people. This generation is a generation of leprosy. Not literally, but you know what he means. Everybody's got leprosy. And we've had this problem throughout Jewish history. In Egypt, there were people who tell, you know, who were into Lashon Hara. And then it popped up in the Second Temple also. And today we're in Gauls. It's just getting bigger and bigger. Who knows if it'll lead to a Holocaust or not? That's why I said I'm going to put myself into this subject. Maybe the blind among the Hebrews, meaning the morally blind, will listen, and they'll change. My friends, this week is Parsha Zohar. If you want to know what happened in Poland in 1602, in Parsha Zohar, they all went to hear the Kli Yakar give a speech. And all the VIPs in Poland were there, the rich and the rabbis, and I let him have it. So he could get away with it because he was that good. But after a while, people didn't like the criticism anymore because he called on the line. He would say, you know, what are you doing with the money to tzedakah now? What happened to the money that was supposed to go to the widows and the orphans? Who's in charge of the basin over here? How come they favored the powerful and they didn't favor the way it's supposed to be? It's not fair. And he was a little bit too accurate in his depictions. And as a result, he raised it to a great level. He's a very good writer. I saw once the Sephardim at that time always made fun of the Ashkenaz, correctly so, because the Ashkenaz rabbis don't know Hebrew, meaning I'm talking about dikduk and grammar and melitza. The Sephardim of our great Ashkenazi Gedolim, especially in those centuries, you know what they're saying, and they're good writers, but they don't use proper Ivrit so well. And they don't use, you know, nouns and adjectives all the rest of it well. And he does. So he was a very orderly mind. You know, he studied dikduk first. And I once saw a Sephardi writer saying, who is this guy? It can't be Ashkenaz. Because he writes the correct Hebrew. They tell me he's in Poland, but I don't believe it. So it's like really funny in that regard. Now, me, myself, and I, if you're in the rabbi business, then he's the author among many books of Olalos Ephraim, which is three volumes. And again, it's a very good cheater book, like I said a couple weeks ago, but it's Arya Figo. These are the These are meat and potatoes of the old rabbis, because he was a speaker, and he published his speeches in popular form so other rabbis could buy it and cheat off of him. And it's called Olas Ephraim. And this is the sefer you want to get. 3 volumes. This is the sefer you want to get because he has a Dvar Torah for every parsha for a bris. You know what I mean? Let's say you have a bris this week and you want something for Vayikra, or next week you want Parsha's Tzav and so forth, all through. He's got something, every parsha in the Chumash for Sheva Brachos. He's got for every Yontif, for Shabbos, for Purim, for Chanukah. And let me say this, it's not fluff. His ideas are deep ideas. He was a gadol, so he deals with deep and heavy ideas, and he will produce it. For example, if he's going to talk about Purim, I'm sure he's going to talk about the Kavlam HaKagigas. You know, how does Purim, they say, Purim remedied the Kavlam HaKagigas, that God forced the Torah on the Jews, and therefore they had a complaint against it, but in the time of Purim, they changed it. Why, my friends, would Purim be a time which is the opposite of Kavlam HaKagigas? And he'll explain in very solid ways. So this is the book. If you ever need a speech for anything, it's like one of the big three, as I said before. Anybody knows the Sifrut HaDrush, this genre of great, what's the right word? I hate to use the word sermonic literature because it's much more substantial than that. But that's what it is. The big three are the Azar Yafigo, the Bin Elitim, and the Olas Ephraim of our person today, Rosh Shlomo Zalman Ephraim of Lunshitz, the Kli Yakar, and the other one is the Rionis and Abshitz, the Yaros Dvash. These are things that made him outstanding and separate. Most of his life, he was in Poland till, you know, like, I think until he was like 60 years old. And then when later in life, I think he must have rubbed too many people the wrong way, so he came to Prague. At the same time as the Maharal. As a matter of fact, if you want to know who he was in terms of learning, he succeeded the Maharal. The Maharal was the Maharal of Prague, the rabbi of the community of Prague. You know what a giant the Maharal was. And when he left, his successor was the Kli Yakar. Right? He was the rabbi after Maharal. So to be a rabbi of a community like that, you got to know how to learn, baby. Matter of fact, Prague was notorious. They would cut you up. The city was full of Talmidei Chachamim, and they liked nothing but to shecht. They liked nothing but to shecht the rabbi, and it made him feel good. And in order to give a speech successfully, a shir or a Shabbos gadol or something like that, you had to be prepared to face down your critics. And if he was willing to do so, you can imagine it was really impressive. But as I said before, his main mark was an orator. And a darshan in the highest sense of the word. Now, as I said before, he was very organized and he was not politically correct. So he was afraid, he wasn't afraid to call a spade a spade. And what's really interesting remark about him is he is famous among historians as one of the biggest critics of the yeshiva system. It's funny. Now, in Poland, I told you it's the golden age of Polish Jewry, right? And what do you call it? And the golden age of Polish Jewry, there were yeshivas everywhere. And there was quantity for sure. But he says the system stinks because it's all based on parents wanting to rush their kids too quickly to learn Gemara, 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 so they could show off the others that their kid is a genius. I'm going to take the time now to read with you a passage or two. It'll take me 2 minutes or so and translate it to give you an idea of the flavor of his writings and of his criticisms of the chinuch system at that time. I'll make no comment about the chinuch system of today. And he has a book, one of his svarim is called Amudei Shesh, 6 pillars, where he talks about the 3 pillars. You know, it says in Pirkei Avos, the world stands on 3 things, Torah, Avodah, Gemilas, Chasanim, and then it says another 3 things a few mishnas later, Din, Emes, V'Shalom, I think. So let's talk about Torah. And he says, Amud, it's a short paragraph, Amud HaTorah B'Doreinu Rofef Ma'ob. The pillar of Torah in this generation is pretty darn weak. But Tolar Tzablim, actually, it's hanging on a thread. Ki b'chol darchi alimud, because in all the teaching methods in our schools, ein ben mesom, there's nothing good. Miyom amdo al daita ki askin, from the time a kid enters the yeshiva system as a kid until he gets old. Ki b'terem yeda anal hanar mos barah, as soon as a kid is very young, they would start you in cheder very young. He's handed off to a malamed, the lamdo mikra, to teach him chumash. What did he teach him chumash? Tam b'psukim parshas Bereishis, yachach shu abo, noach. So the old system was, this week is parshas Bereishis, he learned a few psukim of the course of the week through rote and memorization, he translated the Yiddish, and then next week Bereishis is over, so after learning 4, 5, or 6, or 7 psukim from Bereishis, he moved to Noach. and do the same thing in Parshas Noach, and then 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 Pesukim, and then you move to Lech Lecha, and every week you go back to Parshas Shavuot. So what's the result? The kid is a little kid. He has no idea what's flying. He doesn't know what happened in Parshas Bereishis. He doesn't know about Avraham Avinu. Ainu Malamdim Kim Pirush Hamilos. So all you're doing is drilling into his head like translations of words. V'lo Pirush Chibur HaPesukim. You don't explain him how the text flows. You don't give him a narrative. V'yafu Yimin Kol HaParsha Chibur Yom. Even if he would learn the whole Parsha, it's bad enough that he only learns a few Pesukim here and Pesukim there. If it's strictly rote translation without any explanation, what's the point? And with this junk in his head, confusion, Mishnah Gemara. As soon as possible, he put him in a class to learn Mishnayos and Gemara. If you ask him basic Judaism, tell me about the unity of God, or Kabbalah Sol Shamayim, or Yiras Hashem, you know anything. My friends, this is the way it is. There's a lot of schools out there, I don't want to say too much, you'd be shocked at what the kids don't know. I'm talking about already by the time they get to high school. And you think they know. How do you teach a kid like that who doesn't know anything? Mishnah said Gemara. He knows nothing from the Chumash. And his whole education at the young age in Chumash and things like that is nothing but Limud HaLashon. Turns out to be just translation. Well, it's a translation. He said, get a dictionary. What do you have to go through the Chumash that way? I don't call this Limud HaTorah. Zu Torah. And then he says, you move to the next stage. They teach them Gemaras which are not no gay to anything. Erevin, Chundig Muslim. A kid doesn't need to know that. A kid should know Brachas maybe, Shabbos. You know, practical things that do for their daily life. So since they learning them, teaching them, Gittin and Yavamas and whatever, it's not no gay to him, you forget it as soon as the semester's over. When the intoxication is up, you don't remember anything of what you learned. The only thing you can say is he learned the system of the Gemara, you know, the Gemara talk and the Gemara way of thinking. But now he doesn't know a single mitzvah to do it correctly. And he doesn't know any mussar which would be good for a kid to learn. And he goes on and on and on, and he says, that's why our kids have no derecherets, and that's why they scream, and that's why they're rough to each other. And boy, oh boy, oh boy. And then he goes after the higher learning, what they used to call the pilpul and the chalukim, which is very hard to explain in a context like this, and my time's almost out. But the system of learning at that time, I'm talking about the advanced system. They don't have this anymore. What I'm talking about went out of business about 200 years ago, 250 years ago. But they did at that time, it was wildly popular, and he couldn't take it because the Kliyaker was, among other things, a follower of the morale. He didn't learn, I don't think, by the morale, but he followed the morale. And the morale was a guy who said, Mishnayos, Mishnayos, Mishnayos. Learn the basics and only then move on to the Gemara. The Kli Yakar is very much into this idea. First, you learn Chumash and Tanakh, get that down cold. Then you learn Mishnayos, get that down cold. Then from there, you move on to Gemara and get that down cold. And then you move to the Lumdas, meaning in a curricular fashion, in a solid fashion. But he said, I know nobody will listen to me because everybody wants to be a little Vilna Gaon or something like that, and the parents should show off. And the result is we have a generation where lots of kids leave the yeshiva because they're frustrated, because the learning doesn't work for them, because it doesn't work for anybody normal. And a lot of kids who could be in learning or would be balabatim, who, as we would say today, either attend a daf yom yeshir or even give a daf yom yeshir, fall by the wayside because it allows the education system. The truth is there's a lot more to say on this, but I don't want to take too much time out of here. I would just, maybe in another year or something like that. The criticism of the pilpul is very, very interesting. But I won't do it now. I'll simply say that I would recommend, tomorrow's the Zion Ador, is the yard site. You can either do the easy way and look up a Kli Yakar. I bet you'd even have those online. He's always got good stuff on every Parsha. I myself went through a phase where I was into it, but I'm not anymore. It's not my style. The Olas Ephraim is fantastic. If you have the patience, you're looking for good material on any holiday, if you have, like I say, a bris, a yard site, a Sheva Brachas, or anything, you know, any of that sort of business. His other drushes are also very good, but you have to be a little bit learned to follow them. They're brilliantly constructed, but they're all based on the fact he expects you to know a certain amount of material. He had a very orderly mind. That's why he's into Mishnayos first and Gemara later. He just had a naturally orderly mind. That's why he was into Dikduk, in order to do everything in the right way. If he was around today, he would be either considered eccentric or he'd be moving and shaking to try to change the yeshiva system in this way or that way. I don't know. But that's who he was. As a result of this, he was always a controversial figure. And as I said before, he did spend a number of years as the rabbi in Prague, which means that he was trying to sit on a powder keg because everybody's trying to undermine him. Everyone wants to show what a big lamdan they are. If you pask in a shayla, everybody will say this is wrong. The people don't understand. In the old days, if you came to a community of Talmid Chacham, it's a blood sport to be the rabbi. Anybody volunteer for this job was a gladiator. He had to be ready to take on all kinds of challenges and smile and go with it. So Kli Yochar is a very, very unusual person. I would just throw in one last part, and that is, he's philosophical. It's clear that he was one of these orators who knew the Rambam's Guide for the Perplexed, the Kuzari, some of these other books, and therefore he's able to use the philosophical concepts of the great Jewish works in the Middle Ages in his drushes, which is something that a lot of people don't do. You know, you see a parsha, we just had Parsha Pekudi, and it said the cloud rested on the Mishkan, and the Kavod Hashem, the glory of God, filled the Mishkan. What does that mean? What kind of a cloud is it? What do you mean glory? He raises these questions. And I'll just end, because it's late, with a classic Kli Yochar that I happen to remember for some reason every year, where he really ripped off the hypocrisy. And that's in Parsha Shmini. And how's it go now? It says, Shmini, as you know, is when they inaugurated the Mishkan. And it says, Kara Moshe li Aaron Ovono, Lichne Israel. And he said to Aaron, Krav el Mizbeach, step forward. Today you're going to be inaugurated as Kohen Gadol. Vaseis Kar, as Olos v'schatos. Aaron was given a calf to be a carbon chatos, a sin offering. Ooh, what a diss. And Aaron was embarrassed because he made the golden calf. And the Jewish people were murmuring. And then the Pasuk says like this, El Bnei Yisrael Tadaber Lemar. God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, tell the Jewish people they should bring an eagle, the Klal Yisrael should bring an eagle as an ola, right? And then they bring some other animal, a sawyer or something, as the chatos. So why is it that Aaron, he says, is told to bring a calf for a chatos, and the Jewish people are told to bring a calf for an ola? This is a Kli Yochar now. And he says like this, people are hypocrites. God was saying, cut the baloney. Aaron made the golden calf. That's true. What is a chatos? A chatos is when you do a sin, but it's like meshogeg. You did the action, but you did not have the intention. Now let's contrast that with a carbon ola. Carbon ola is a voluntary offering, because that's a bad machshava. So you didn't do something, but you wanted to, which is why an ola is always a voluntary offering, because how does anybody know what somebody was thinking? If you have a bad conscience, which is a good thing to have, then you want to bring a carbon ola because you had bad machshavas. So God is saying, says the Kli Yochar like this, Aaron made it, but he didn't believe in it. But you guys believed in it. So he should bring a chatos, which means he did it, the act, but not the intention. But B'nai Yisrael said that, but the Jewish people should bring an ola, which means they believed in it, they just didn't make it because they told Aaron to make it. And so in the choice of the carbon, God was exposing the hypocrisy of the masses. That's a typical Kli Yochar. Our time is up. And may Hashem Aliyah.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.